You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Today we are in the Sierra de la Bandera.
Hello, buenas tardes from La Vuelta a España. My name is Daniel Freiba. I am the host of tonight's episode, and despite what you heard our friend Rob Hatch just say, I am not on La Pandera. I'm down in Valdepeñas de Jaén, the town at the bottom of the climb, the Anglia of the South, the scene of a brilliant stage victory by Primoz Roglic in last year's Vuelta a España. I interviewed him more or less on the spot where I am recording tonight's podcast. And joining me yet again today from Villefranche-sur-Mer, I think he's there today. He's more Motown than Monaco, more Grand Rapids than French Riviera, more Chevrolet than Saint-Tropez. He is the current AG2R Citroën professional, veteran of four Vueltas, Tour de Suisse stage winner, 2017 US National Road Race champion. He has the legs, the looks, the luscious locks, and most importantly, the searing insight that keeps the listeners coming back. He is Larry Warbass. Lucky Larry.
Good to be here, yeah. Also, I'm not where you thought I was today. I'm actually in La Mora in Italy right now. So,
Even better. Yeah. What takes you there apart from the Barolo?
Yeah, well, actually, I have a good friend staying with me from the U.S. this week, and he's really into wine. So we decided to come make a trip up here just for the night. So yeah, his last night in Europe.
And tell us about La Mora, just in the name of making Brian Nygaard jealous. He's already slightly jealous that he's not on tonight's program, but he will be on tomorrow. Just tell us, nice. How's La Mora looking?
Oh, it's beautiful. I mean, okay, a little cloudy today, but it's a beautiful place, you know, middle of all the vineyards in the heart of the Langhe. And yeah, pretty cool. So my friend's definitely pumped to be here. So we actually left him at a vineyard doing some wine tasting. So hopefully we find him still on 2 feet and alive when the podcast is finished.
Is this a visit, Larry, that your team manager, Vincent Lavenue, would authorize?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm still training well and everything. I just came for the night. It's not okay. Like I came, for some big bender for a week or something.
Yeah,
you
10
know?
Day so. Wine tasting junket. Larry, it's also very beautiful where I am. As I said, we're in the province of Jaén, and no podcast visit to Jaén would be complete without an eye-watering stat about olive oil production plucked from Google. So today I'm going to tell you, I think I told the listeners this last year, this province has 60 million olive trees and accounts for 20 to 25% of the world's olive oil. Not Europe's or Spain's, the world's. It's actually 40 or 50% of Spain's olive oil as well. You've probably been down here, haven't you, Larry? You will have been.
Yeah,
it's quite a sight, isn't it? As everyone will have seen today on TV. On the subject of pitted fruit, I've also got a bit of a bone to pick with you, Larry. You were in Traverse City all last week, and you didn't mention the fact there's a cherry pit spitting championship in
it's the cherry capital of the world.
Yeah, that takes place in Traverse,
home of the
City.
Cherry Festival.
You did not.
I would have definitely
this.
Participated in many cherry pit spitting contests in my youth. So I'd say I'm quite an expert pit spitter, actually.
So this is measured on distance.
Yeah, distance. Yeah.
What's a good spit?
Good technique.
What distance?
I mean, it's pretty far. You know, I mean, I don't know. I honestly, I can't remember, but it'd be at least like 5 meters or something, you know, maybe a little further. You know, you kind of like get a running start and then you just, you know, get a really good, really good thrust. And there's quite a technique to it.
I'm almost as interested. You're getting me almost as interested in the world of cherry spitting as I am in the Vuelta a España. Speaking of contests, Well, today was a fantastic stage, and we've got a contest, or at least a challenge, for you coming, Larry. As every day, you are in charge of summarising today's stage. You are the only participant in the stage summary time trial. So I'm going to ask Rob Hatch to introduce you.
El resumen del día a contrarreloj. The stage summary time trial.
And Larry, my finger is poised over the stopwatch. You're going to have 90 seconds to tell us what happened on a barnstorming day here at the Vuelta. Off you go, Larry.
Beep.
Okay, so today was stage 14 from Montoro to Sierra de la Pandera, 160.3 kilometers with 3,341 meters of climbing. It was a mountaintop finish up to 1,815 meters. And yeah, the stage was won by Richard Carapaz, second Miguel Angel Lopez, and third Primoz Roglic. That doesn't exactly explain how they arrived there because there was a 10-man breakaway. It took quite a long time to escape, and there were some other small moves before, but in the end, the 10 men who escaped were Luis Leon Sanchez, Richard Carapaz, Clément Champoussin, Philippe Oconca, Alexey Lutsenko, Bruno Armirai, Kenny Ellison, Mads Peterson, Raul Garcia Pierna, and Marco Brenner. And yeah, in the end, there was, you know, kind of a thinning out on the final climb, and in the end, Richard Carapaz was the only guy who survived from that breakaway to take the stage. Behind, in the group behind, there was a little bit of a battle. Roglic attacked pretty early, and yeah, he dropped the red jersey Evenepoel, who showed a little bit of weakness, lost some time, not like an enormous amount. He finished 56 seconds down on the winner, so 48 seconds to Carapaz. Primoz Roglic, and yeah, now Roglic is a minute 49 behind Evenepoel in the overall, and Enric Mas is at 2:43, so he gains a little bit of time as well.
And your
yeah,
time,
I'd
Larry,
say those are the important things.
And your time, Larry, is up. The listeners will have noticed you measuring your words very carefully there, saying that he'd lost a little bit of time, Remco. I think you and I are going to have an argument later about what this means for the general classification. We've already had half an argument off air, off mic. But what a fantastic stage it was. You mentioned there the early breakaway. You had a couple of, well, you had a teammate in there, Clément Champoussin. You also had a couple of mates. I think Kenny Ellison is a good pal of yours, isn't he? A training partner, fellow inhabitant
until he moved to Andorra, but yeah.
I was about to say fellow inhabitant of the Côte d'Azur. But we monitored, we watched that break form with interest this morning, obviously it wasn't this morning, it was after lunchtime by the time they got together. And when Carapaz had made it across, obviously he became the favourite, particularly after his stage win a couple of days ago. But prior to that, there were a couple of more tentative moves, or certainly more unsuccessful moves. One of them was launched by Thomas De Gendt, the breakaway specialist. And I know he has a big following, particularly on social media and also among podcast listeners. So I just thought it'd be interesting for those listeners to hear what he's saying, what he has been saying about his Vuelta a España. I spoke to him yesterday morning in Ronda, and this might explain why Thomas De Gendt has been struggling a little bit to infiltrate those breakaways here at the Vuelta. So here's Thomas De Gendt speaking yesterday morning.
I was good in the start, but then the first days when we were in Spain, I started to get some stomach problems, and that takes up a lot of strength in those days and the days after to recover. And then the last days were just not really good stages for me to try something. So I tried on the last day in Asturias, but I couldn't get away. And yesterday I tried also, but I was not in the right break. So yeah.
Some Belgian colleagues told me that, well, you tried to prepare for this race mainly with training rather than racing. I know you did Poland, but was it a slightly different approach to this Vuelta?
Yeah, normally I do the Tour and then the Vuelta afterwards. So now, because I didn't do the Tour de France, I had to do a training camp. So that was different than that I'm used to. I did altitude training. And the last time I did this was like 2017 or 16 or something. So my body didn't react like I hoped it would. So
cycling's changed since then as well.
Yeah, everybody goes on altitude, so maybe it's still a little different, and I'm a bit better than I'm supposed to, but all the rest also goes on altitude, so yeah, there is no benefit in it anymore.
So, Larry, that was Thomas De Gendt, well, talking, among other things, about spending time at altitude, but feeling as though it's not as much of an advantage as it used to be, because everyone's at altitude all the time these days, pretty much. And on that subject, actually, I had a bit of a laugh this morning with Jetse Bol, the Burgos Biache rider from Avenhorn, I think the place is called, in the Netherlands. And every year before the Vuelta, I do a general classification based on the altitude of rider's birth, and he always comes in bottom, because where he lives, Avonhorn is below the level of the sea, minus 2 meters. He confirmed that to me this morning. Well, we are certainly in the mountains at the moment, Larry. Tomorrow we're going to have the highest mountaintop finish of the Vuelta, one of the highest mountaintop finishes, in fact, that you ever get in professional cycling, 2,500 and something meters above sea level in the Sierra Nevada. I think, and again, we're going to discuss this a bit later, but I think there's blood in the water tonight. I think Primoz Roglic has drawn that blood. He can certainly smell that blood. And, well, I think the momentum has shifted today. So we are going to hear from Primoz Roglic. But before that, we're going to hear from King Kenny, your mate Kenny Elisson, who was in that break, but unfortunately couldn't get the stage win today. And between the two of them, we've also got Chris Harper, who did a fantastic job as a domestique for Primoz Roglic today, as he, well, as he set about Remco Evenepoel, Quick Step, and as I said, he did draw some blood on La Pandera. So first it's Kenny Elisson, then Chris Harper, then Primoz Roglic.
Yeah, it was nice. I was not really in the plan. Actually, I was a bit sick, so I was like, maybe okay, I'm gonna recover to try to be more better next week. But then, yeah, after 80k with Matt, we say okay, let's go, and he went. And yeah, after, actually it was nice because I took some pleasure, and you know, Matt is so generous in the effort, you know, he gave me everything to help me, and yeah, that's a champ. Maybe you think everybody is tired, but then when Luis Leon Sanchez and Carapaz started to attack, I felt he was a bit out of reach today.
Yeah, really good day. It's good to see when you're coming into the race that Primoz would probably progressively get better. So yeah, that's starting to show, and just chip away at Remco's lead day by day. Primoz felt good, so he told us to sort of take over and make it hard. Also with the idea to try go for the stage. So yeah, my role was just to try set a high tempo on the final climb. Of course, it's I think motivating for everyone to see Primoz getting stronger and stronger. But yeah, we believe from the start that he can win this bike race, and yeah, that's only getting more and more confirmed.
Nice day, but yeah, you all know, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose a bit, but yeah, hopefully we can keep this trend. Like I said, I'm feeling better, we race now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still quite far, and but yeah, the race is
also still long.
The guys really did a great job. Yes, each and every one of them really pushed hard, and happy to be a part of the team, and looking forward for the next days.
Today is today, and tomorrow.
The cycling podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, the title sponsors of the cycling podcast, of course. If you want to find out more about Super Sapiens and the system of continuous glucose monitoring, go to supersapiens.com. We've been hearing from Sam Brand, who rides for Novo Nordisk. Now, Sam is a type 1 diabetic, and he has learned over the years of monitoring his glucose levels in real time that what goes up must come down, and vice versa. And he has mastered the art of keeping his blood glucose levels in the performance zone, because it's vital, not just for how he rides on the bike, but also for his health. And what he's learned is something that we can all take on board to improve the way we fuel for racing and training.
Well, yeah, I mean, like when I see a sort of a drop in on my blood glucose, then obviously it might require some more fast-acting glucose, so that might be a gel. Depends on how the graph looks in terms of, if I'm dropping quick, I might need a gel, as opposed to if I'm just riding at a sedate level, steady, or in the brake, but at cruising speed, shall we say, that might require, still going to require energy, but it might require like a bar or something that's a longer lasting fuel. So that's kind of making those decisions on the fly and understanding how that's going to work in the next 2 to 3 hours is quite like insightful, and it's really good for me to be able to see that live.
El Diario Remco, the Daily Remco.
You never know what happens. It's a three-week race. Yesterday would have been an easy stage, but it was not that easy because of the wind and the stress in the bunch. So I just hope I recovered well. I had a good night of sleep, and I just hope that today the legs will be good, and then that tomorrow I will not. That the legs will still be okay after today's stage.
On Sunday night, will you be happy with the status quo, or would you wish for a bigger cushion?
I think I will be happy if I can keep the lead like it is now. I don't really need to win a stage. I already got one, so that's already a done deal. But I mean, yeah, now it's important to keep the jersey. And even with like a 10, 15, 20 second time loss, I will not be stressed, because that's not so much on finishes like this. But it's always better to keep the same advantage.
Remco, you said you slept well. Any issues with your hand or your hip from the crash the other day? Nothing?
No gloves, so full confidence in my hands.
So we heard there, Larry, that the gloves were off as far as Remco Evenepoel was concerned this morning. No issues from the crash. How many days ago is it now? Was it yesterday? No, 2 days ago.
Two days ago.
When he did hurt his hand, we talked about it then. He came in with a ripped short and quite a deep cut, it looked like, on his right hip, if I remember correctly. But he said he'd been sleeping well. So there was no sign this morning, as you heard there. He was sounding pretty chipper, as he has been throughout this welter. There was no sign that a bad day was coming. Contrast that with the statements in the press conference this evening, when to me he looked a little bit more irritable than he has been up until now during this welter, understandably. But in the press conference this evening, he said, well, it was one of the hardest days. Certainly it took about 80 kilometers for the break to go, so that made it hard. He said, we lost a small battle, not the big battle. And he said, it was my turn to lose time today. That's just the life of a Grand Tour. He said, from the height of his two Grand Tours to a 1.5 Grand Tours worth of experience. So, Larry, and we said there's blood in the water, let's sink our teeth into this now. You don't believe there is any cause to panic for Remco Evenepoel and Quickstep tonight. Am I right?
Yeah. I don't think yet. So, you know, I think Remco is a lot more intelligent rider than probably a lot of people give him credit for. I think he knows, his limits and his capabilities. And if he's not feeling like 110%, I think he's going to ride at his own pace that he knows he can hold, and he's not going to push it. So, you know, I'll never forget I think it was 2019 when Remco won San Sebastian. I was on Erlites. We got dropped together, and I remember, like, I was like, okay, this guy looks like he's, you know, going a good pace. So I sat on his wheel, and in the end, we caught back to the peloton because they were going, you know, really hard, and we both got dropped at the same time. And we rode back to the peloton, and I was like, thanks. You know, it was like a good tempo. And he's like, yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. Like, clearly they couldn't keep riding that hard. So I just knew that I should just ride my tempo. And later, you know, he would go on to win the race. I proceeded to get dropped again. But I thought that was something that really struck me. That this guy, kid, who was like, 19 years old at the time, he was able to have that, like, sort of composure to just say, like, okay, you know, I'm just going to let myself get dropped and ride my own tempo. So, you know, looking at today, it wouldn't surprise me if he just said, okay, I'm not feeling 110%. I'm going to ride my own tempo. And, you know, it'd be one thing if he lost 2 minutes, 3 minutes by the top, but he only lost less than 50 seconds. So, I don't think it's cause for worry. If it was like a few more minutes, maybe it'd be something different. But we'll see what happens tomorrow, because tomorrow is a lot harder final climb, and I think that'll give us more answers.
Larry, I want to take you back, not to 2018 and the Giro, the Simon Yates Giro yet, and we'll talk about that later, but I'm going to take you back to the start of the final climb, or just before the start of the final climb. In fact, just before the summit of the Villares, the penultimate climb, when Robert Hasink got on the front of the peloton, Jumbo-Visma took control. And, well, what did you see from that moment on, particularly from Remco? I mean, what did you think was going on at that point? Did you think that he was on a reasonable day? He certainly looked to me as though, well, he didn't look any different from any other day. He was close to to Hasink. I mean, he was on Hasink's shoulder more or less. Primoz Roglic was quite a bit further back in the peloton, and he didn't really betray any sign of weakness at that point. But what did you see up until the moment when daylight finally did open up between Remco and Primoz?
I mean, to be honest, I wasn't really looking that closely at Remco, just because, like, for me, I wasn't expecting him to have, show any sign of weakness or falter just yet. So I'd have to go back now and look for the things, in retrospect to see, like, if there was some sign of weakness. But, you know, I just saw, like, oh, it's interesting. You know, I was like, Roglic must be on a good day if, like, you guess Sink is going full like this. So, I guess at the time I didn't really think anything of Remco in particular, and I was just kind of surprised when he gets dropped. But he's also the kind of guy who looks really, really solid at all times. So, you know, it's kind of like he looks totally fine until one moment he kind of explodes or gets dropped. So it's really hard with riders like that. Actually, my teammate Oliver Nossen is someone who's really similar, who's just his position on the bike and the way he pedals, you know, he looks really good and he's never all over the place until one moment he just totally blows. And then they start to show like weakness, right? So it's interesting because, you know, he doesn't have the typical tells of some of the other guys who maybe are all over the place, or, you know, he's definitely not Maury Van Sevenant, his teammate. But yeah, it's hard to tell with him. So yeah, maybe you'd have to look back more closely and see if there's anything you can really see.
I mentioned the 2018 Giro d'Italia and Simon Yates. Of course, most of us remember, I think all of us remember, how he lost the pink jersey on the climb that went over the Colle delle Finestre that then was gone down in cycling history because of Chris Froome's attack to effectively steal the Giro d'Italia, and Yates collapsed completely. But the day before, I have almost more vivid memories of the day before and the climb to Prato Nevoso, when he didn't give away much, but it was the first time in that Giro d'Italia when he had given away any time on a significant climb. And he lost 43 seconds to Superman Lopez that day, a bit less from Froome. But Remco lost 48 seconds from Primoz Roglic today, plus the bonus. And I just got those vibes today. And I'm a big believer, from the height of my 0 years of experience riding Grand Tours, I'm a big believer in momentum in Grand Tours, particularly when it comes to general classification riders. But you might tell me, Larry, that it doesn't work like that, that perhaps we should take what Remco said at face value, i.e. it was a bad day, and you'll always get a bad day in a Grand Tour, whether you're riding high in general classification or you're in the belly of the bunch.
I mean, I think the thing is with Remco is, like, we just don't have any trends yet with him to really know. So, I don't know. I'm still not going to write him off just yet. You know, I think we'll see tomorrow. But even to me, even if he's strong tomorrow, that doesn't mean he's not going to crack in the third week, because, like, you know, if we look back, like, he was absolutely flying in San Sebastian, which was, you know, a few weeks before the Vuelta. So that's a really long time to be on top form. And you don't ride as fast as he did in San Sebastian unless you're in top form, no matter who you are. So, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if he starts to falter sometime soon. But I don't know. I'm not ready to write him off just yet. It looks like Roglic is getting stronger, and that's, you know, what it sounded like. I'm sure we'll listen to this later in the podcast, his director said. If Roglic is getting stronger and maybe Remco's form is starting to teeter off a tiny bit, it's possible. But I'm not going to write him off just yet, because you really just never know.
And I detected today, Larry, just around the team, and you mentioned Adi Engels, the direct sportif, who we'll hear from later. I detected a bullishness about Jumbo-Visma that I haven't previously seen at this Vuelta a España. There was a spark. We heard it from Chris Harper earlier on. Primoz himself, Roglic, didn't give too much away. Today is today, tomorrow is tomorrow. And that was kind of, that was a typical Roglicism. But there was fire, I saw some fire in his legs today, and that is the most important thing. But I do, again, it has to do with momentum, and I just feel as though the prevailing wind blowing over this Vuelta a España switched direction today. That's my sense.
Okay, well, I guess we'll see you tomorrow.
We will. Larry, let's just talk also for a moment about Enric Mas. Again, what did you see there? There was a brief moment. There was a time window of about 2 minutes when it looked as though Enric Mas was going to win this Vuelta a España. When he was following Primoz Roglic, didn't look to be in any great difficulty. And, of course, Enric Mas is... he's ahead of Primoz Roglic still on general classification. Is he? No, he's not. He's dropped below him. But he started the day ahead of Primoz Roglic on general classification. So at that point, he was the clubhouse leader, in effect, of this, or he could have been, of this Vuelta a España, because at one stage it did look as though Remco...
He didn't start.
Did he not?
He didn't start in front of Primoz. No.
You're much better.
It's been a few days, sorry.
You're much better.
It was the TT day.
Oh, no. You're a much better podcaster than me, Larry. Anyway.
No, I'm not.
You get the picture, Larry. You get the picture. Enric Mas was looking in good shape. He was looking well-placed. And then, all of a sudden, we saw him spinning. He obviously... went right up his cassette, right up the gears and started spinning a tiny gear, I think his smallest gear, but there was clearly no power in the legs because everyone was riding away from him. What happened there?
I mean, you know, I think we're talking about minute differences between these guys. So, you know, I mean, he lost not even 30 seconds to Primoz in the end. So, you know, I think it's just, yeah, it's... You're coming now. We're in, you know, stage 14, second week of the Grand Tour. You know, hard climb, end of the day. You know, it's hot down there. I think it's just like, you know, there's just these tiny, minute differences. And if you go a tiny bit over your limit, then you can definitely pay for it. So, you know, he was able to follow Roglic for a while. And then I think he probably just went a tiny bit over the limit. And then, you know, semi-exploded, but in the end it wasn't, you know, something catastrophic because, yeah, he lost 28 seconds. So I think, you know, you got to try, right? And so who knows, it's maybe Roglic accelerated a tiny bit at the end or just he couldn't keep holding the pace, but luckily for him it wasn't anything too catastrophic.
Larry, you mentioned limits there. And every rider's limit.
Yeah.
How do you personally define your limit nowadays? Is it an amalgamation, a sort of composite of watts and heart rate and maybe something else and maybe sort of softer factors, more subjective factors, just how you feel yourself? Or do you have a number of watts and you know that that's your limit on any given climb?
You know, so for me, it depends on the situation. You know, in training, I would be using my watts, my heart rate, whatever, and then I'd be training to a certain... you know, power, heart rate, you know, things like that. In the race, I'd really try to go more off of feeling. I try not to look at the watts. I try not to look at my heart rate. And a lot of times I'll just put speed and I go off that. It's different if I'm in the breakaway because then, you know, the whole day out, you kind of want to pace yourself. If it's a long climb, you pace yourself. But when you're with other guys, when you're in the bunch, I think... If you're really looking too much at the numbers, at the heart rate, at the power, in the end you can, I don't know, I think you can kind of limit yourself. So I know some of my best performances have happened when I've just shut everything off and I've just gone blind and gone off a feeling because, you know, in the end, if you've done it long enough, you can really pace yourself quite well off of feeling. And I think you're holding yourself back if you're really just limiting yourself to certain numbers. So
how typical,
it depends, you know.
How typical is what you're describing, your particular
I
approach?
Think it's a lot more common than people think. I think a lot of the guys in the peloton don't really like to psych themselves out with numbers or heart rate because you're only looking down when you're going hard. You know, if you're cruising along and you're doing whatever 150 watts, you're never looking at your power then, right? It's only when you're like, wow, this is hard, and you look down and then you see a big number. So I think, yeah, it's pretty typical. But maybe early on in a race, guys will look at their power more. They'll say, like, okay, I don't want to, like, make too many accelerations over a certain number. You know, you see sprinters or other guys sag climbing, so they'll start at the front of the bunch when they hit the bottom of a climb. And, you know, if it's not a critical moment of the race, they'll sort of sag all the way to the back. So you can avoid all the little micro accelerations in the middle of the peloton if you do that and you ride to your numbers. But then at the end of the day, you get to the final climb, you need to be there, you need to be with the other guys, you need to follow the wheel in front of you, and it doesn't really serve a whole lot to pace yourself. The only time that it might be slightly different is if you're on a really steep climb where perhaps like drafting doesn't really come into play. Then you can maybe go your own pace and ride to your watts. But yeah, I think a lot of times guys limit themselves if they are looking at the numbers. And I know most guys try to avoid looking at that because it can psych you out.
When it came to dosing his effort, Richard Carapaz certainly, well, he did a masterful job today. Did you, like me, as soon as you saw that he was in that break, fear or think there was only one outcome, really, that it was an inevitability that he would take his second stage win?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I was pretty confident he was going to win when I saw the composition of the breakaway. But again, you know, it's hard to say because the other day when he won the first time, when I saw Jay Vine was in that breakaway, I also thought he was going to win based on his prior two performances. So it's kind of hard to say when you're in a group, especially when you're really favored. I think everyone looks at you. A lot of guys don't want to work with you. Maybe you have to do a little more work than the others, and that can tire you out for the finish. So, I mean, I thought he probably had a better chance to win than any of the others, but I didn't think it was exactly a foregone conclusion. So,
Larry, he was in the break with one of your teammates, Clément Champoussin. At one stage, it was those two and Luis Leon Sanchez together at the head of the race, and it suddenly came to me that there was those two, Carapaz and Champoussin, have one thing in common. They have the same agent, Mr. Quadro, the Italian. But tell us about Clément Champoussin, because I think I mentioned him in one of your previous appearances on the podcast. He is a guy who has been sort of anointed as one of the great hopes of French cycling. Won a stage in the Vuelta, won what everyone in cycling now refers to as the Superman stage in the Vuelta last year, not because Superman Lopez starred, quite the opposite. It was the day when he got off his bike and walked out of his Movistar career. But Champoussin won that stage. But yeah, tell me about Clément Champoussin.
Well, yeah, actually, he's a pretty interesting kid. I'll call him a kid because, yeah, he's young, but he also, to me, he just seems kind of like a kid still. You know, he lives with his parents. He's Niçois, so he's one of... He might be the only Niçois, like originally Niçois professional cyclist. There's plenty of professional cyclists who live down, you know, south of France, Côte d'Azur, but he comes from there, his family comes from there, and yeah, he's really the hometown boy. So anytime I go training, everyone always asks me about Clément Champoussin, but he's really a giant talent.
Surely you're the big kid on campus down there on the Côte d'Azur.
Well, you know, I don't have that real hometown advantage there. I think Traverse City, Michigan is more where that is for me. But yeah, it's okay down there. But yeah, so, you know, he's really a huge talent. He came from mountain biking and yeah, he switched to the road a little bit later. I think I don't know if he was French national champion in the juniors or something in the mountain bike, something like that.
I think he was, yeah.
Okay, yeah, and so he's really talented on the mountain bike. He actually jumped in the French National Championships mountain bike for the pros last year, and I think he was sixth or seventh starting last row. So, yeah, pretty impressive guy. And I mean, you know when you guys use the term whimsical flaneur,
yes,
I think for like,
yes,
Warren Barguil?
Yes.
He is about equivalent. So he just kind of like does what he wants. He doesn't really like, speaking of power meters, he doesn't really like to use a power meter. He didn't ever use one before he turned a pro. And I think, like, he never calibrated his first year pro. Half the time the battery was dead. I don't think he really knows what Training Peaks is. Yeah, so it's cool because you know, he just kind of does it the old school way. He rides on feeling. He rides with his buddies. He sprints for a few town signs, and somehow he rocks up to these races can win.
Sounds very Barguil-esque. But of course, he has an alternative nickname, Warren Barguil, the dandelion picker, ramasseur de pissenlits. So maybe we'll go with that, and Clément Champoussin will henceforth be the whimsical flâneur.
Exactly. That's probably good because, he's the kind of guy, like, we get on the bus and say we're supposed to leave at 10 a.m. on the dot, and it's 10:10 and he's still not there, and then someone calls him, and then they say, hey, like, we call him Shampoo, where are you? And he goes, well, I'm in my room. And then, we're leaving. He goes, why? And we were supposed to leave at 10. Oh, yeah, okay, I didn't realize. And then he doesn't run out to the bus, you know, he just walks casually there. So it's pretty funny. He is a really big talent, and he's a good kid, even if he sometimes is a little bit in the clouds. I wouldn't be surprised if we still see him win a stage at the end of this Vuelta.
We'll be featuring another rider or ex-rider who displays similar traits in part 3. But that's still to come.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right.
El ritmo de la vuelta. The rhythm of the vuelta.
This is El ritmo de la vuelta, where we all strut around in ruffled shirts, click our castanets, and shake our hips like Ricky Martin taking on the Carrefour de l'Arbre, all in the name of guiltily reviving the official songs of the Vuelta a España and the races to which they were dedicated. Today, Larry, we're going back to the late summer of 2008, a time when the US and indeed global economy was melting down, and Spanish cycling fans were in a sizzle at the prospect of Alberto Contador taking on his home Grand Tour for the first time. The official song in 2008 was Pretendo Hablarte, I Want to Talk to You, by the Madrid-born songstress Beatriz Luengo, about whom my research this morning yielded absolutely nothing especially interesting. I even wasted 20 minutes listening to a 2008 radio interview in which she mainly talked about the difficulty of ordering croissants in Paris.
Moi je ne veux pas souffrir. Le cœur a ses raisons, mon amour, de ne pas t'appeler ainsi. Moi ce que je veux c'est t'aimer. Je ne veux pas souffrir.
Pretendo hablarte y no decirte que ya no sé vivir si ya no estás aquí. Aquí tan sola estoy y en medio de la nada y entre tanta gente estoy pensando en ti. Las horas pasan, tú ya no estás, yo ya.
So yes, not much to say about that. Instead, I should take the opportunity to tell you that yesterday we did the 2006 Vuelta and its official song. I should have mentioned that En Qué Estrella Estará, in which star it will be, was one of a couple of songs by the group in question, Nena da Conte, which caused significant controversy in Spain for their apparently anti-abortionist subtext. Thank you to one of our listeners, Julio Masip, for pointing this out. But back to 2008 and its Gran Salida in Granada, where I'm lucky to be staying tonight. First stage was a TTT, the winner's Liquigas, and the first leader of the Vuelta, wait for it, friend of the podcast, Pippo Pozzato. Alejandro Valverde took the gold jersey off the Peacock of Sandriga the following day, but Valverde's lead was also short-lived, and indeed it wasn't until stage 13 and the Angliru that the GC battle started to settle. Contador won there and again the next day at the Fuentes del Infierno, literally the Fountains of Hell. Moments later, the Lehman Brothers were going bankrupt and causing the biggest fall in the Dow Jones since 9/11 2001, that is. Contador, literal translation accountant or bookkeeper, how apt, would suffer no collapse and finally won the Vuelta by 46 seconds from Levi Leipheimer. At 25, he was the youngest rider to assemble a full set of all three Grand Tours and the third rider to complete that Grand Slam. After who, Larry? Who else had done the Grand Tour Grand Slam before Contador?
Before Contador. I mean, I don't know. Was it Eddie Merckx?
Eddie Merckx was one. The second one is a little bit more left field.
Is it like Italian Kobe or something?
Italian. No, it was Felice Gimondi.
Oh, that was going to be my next guest, actually.
Oh, of course it was. Larry, in this part, we are going to talk about heroes a little bit. We'll find out why in just a second. But did you have any cycling heroes growing up?
I mean, I would say like growing up, I was definitely a huge fan of Lance Armstrong. You know, I don't know if I would consider him necessarily a hero, but yeah,
The controversial Lance Armstrong, to give him his official name on the podcast.
Okay, yeah. He who must not be named in cycling. But yeah, you know, I mean, you're an American kid, and yeah, he was a huge star. And, you know, I mean, I think if it wasn't for him, a lot of us of my generation wouldn't have ever gotten into cycling. So he definitely did bring a lot to the popularity of our sport and everything. So yeah, growing up, definitely I loved to follow Lance. And then once I started to race more, you know, again, I don't know.
Can I ask you?
Before
we go on, Larry, can I ask you when did sort of the scales fall from your eyes, or when did, as far as Armstrong is concerned, when was the wool pulled from your eyes? Did you sort of start to have doubts and maybe change your view of him as early as, I don't know, 2005, when, you know, after his retirement, published pretty compelling evidence that he'd taken EPO? Or was it as late as, well, more or less the time when you were turning professional in 2012 and he did his famous interview with Oprah Winfrey?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, maybe it was somewhere in between those two times. You know, I mean, I was a kid in 2005, so like, that's not something. I mean, I also didn't know anything about cycling, so, you know, and I'm not French, so I can't say I'm the most skeptical. A lot of people probably think I'm naive, but like, so yeah, definitely when I was 15 years old, that's not something that ever would have crossed my mind, or, you know, I didn't know that was a thing. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe it was like somewhere around 2011, 2012 or something that maybe that would have been something that I realized, you know. So it wasn't until Oprah Winfrey, but yeah.
Oprah Winfrey shattering myths, destroying legends. And then Larry, well, you were about to tell us, I think, about, well, a hero you had, or heroes that you had when you came into the pro peloton, and guys you were maybe, well, looking forward to meeting, riding alongside.
Exactly. So yeah, I mean, I just told this to you off the air, but you know, for me, when I started really racing and getting into racing, for me, like probably the rider I was the biggest fan of was Heinrich Hausler. So maybe not exactly my hero, but you know, he was probably my favorite rider. You know, those Cervelo documentaries, Beyond the Peloton, that they released that year, they were just incredible, and I was in love with them. And they did one on Heinrich Hausler when he was second in Sanremo that year. I think it was 2009, and you know, just barely lost to Cav. I just thought, you know, that was just so cool. And when he won that stage, I can't remember where it was into, but in the 2009 Tour de France solo,
in the Vosges, yeah,
and. For me, that was just incredible. And you know, like the way he was crying when he crossed the finish line, you know, I think I was almost in tears watching it. So like, and I was just like, this guy's incredible. And yeah, then I got the chance to be teammates with him on IM. And it's kind of funny because the first time I met him, I was like, oh, actually, this guy's kind of an asshole.
Never meet the heroes. What was
yeah,
his face
exactly.
Like?
I don't know. He was just kind of a dick the first time I met him, you know, like I don't exactly remember why or how, but I was like, oh, this is a lot less cool than I expected it to be. But actually, over the course of the year, we got to know each other better and race together more. And I think kind of once I earned his respect, we actually became friends. And I really enjoyed being teammates with him. So
this is a bit of a theme of these podcasts, or your accounts of your pro career in these podcasts.
Yeah.
Sort of school of hard knocks that is the pro peloton.
Exactly.
We talked last week about BMC and having to earn the trust, earn the respect of Manuel Quinciato and Marcus Burkhardt, wasn't it? And
yeah,
and you experienced the same again. at I am. Are you as intimidating, Larry, for young
no,
riders?
No, I'm
tough for the
I
young
would
kids?
Be surprised if I was. I would be. I mean, cool. You know, I just don't think I'm that intimidating. So who knows? But potentially to some people, not that I know of. But maybe I should work on my intimidation status. You know.
Yeah, I would agree that you're not that intimidating, Larry. Sorry. This is a subject we have talked about in the podcast before. Heroes, I so famously, you know, among podcast listeners anyway, idolized Pavel Tonkov, which is a bit of a strange left field choice for a hero. Another one, though, and this brings us to our Encuentro del Día, was Oscar Freire. Now, when we did the Ritmo de la Vuelta a few minutes ago, I mentioned the 2008 Vuelta a España. Oscar Freire took one of his 7 Vuelta a España stages there in 2008. Of course, prior to that, he had won 4 Tour de France stages. He also won the green jersey in 2008. He won Gent-Wevelgem. He won 3 San Remos in his career. And most famously, he won 3 rainbow jerseys, 3 world championships. He's now 46, and he has, well, he was always a bit of a cult figure. I don't know if this applies to you, Larry, if you shared this, but Oscar Freire was this sort of mythical figure who never, well, he didn't race very much, often because he was injured. He was very fragile, famously fragile, and when he did race, he would be invisible most of the time in the peloton, and then he would pop up and win these massive races, and notably the world championship. This air of casual insouciance, as the French would say, as they would say down there on the Riviera, Larry, and he did everything with the same sort of air. He had this reputation for being very forgetful, for being a little bit loose in the same way that you described Clément Champoussin, for forgetting things. I visited Oscar Freire at his house in northern Spain in Torrelavega in about 2007. I think I've told the story on the podcast before, how he proudly was showing off to me this new automated lawnmower that he'd bought, this robot, which then proceeded a few seconds later to nosedive off the edge of his lawn and shatter into about 100 pieces. And he also told me a story that day, I remember, about he'd somehow ended up in a shopping trolley on one of those conveyor belts that sort of take you up a slope into a supermarket. He'd somehow, either going up or down, he'd ended up in the shopping trolley. I think he was going down. And this was the kind of thing that happened every day in the life of Oscar Freire. But he carried it off. He sort of could style out anything, and always maintained this sort of enviable air of being very at peace with himself. Anyway, after that very long introduction, they say don't meet your heroes, but I have met Oscar Freire before, wasn't disappointed, and I met him again today. He's at the Vuelta, working for one of the sponsors as an ambassador for the Fertiberia company. I think they make fertilizer, something probably not very sexy, but that's what he's doing at the Vuelta, and I spoke to him this morning at the start in Montoro. So here is Oscar Freire, and he is today's Encuentro del Día.
El Encuentro del Día, the meeting of the day.
I am very lucky in my life, so I enjoy a lot, and I when I stop cycling, I decide to be with my family, and so I have a little investments, but I don't do a really work. So normally my normal life is to be with the family, to go to the school with the children. So it's a really nice life. So I am happy for that.
And you have one son, is it Mateo, who is a cyclist? Well, he's 16 years old and he's already racing.
Yeah, it's Marcos. I have 3, Marcos, Mateo and Manuel. The oldest is 16 years old and is a little cyclist. So when you are 16, so now everybody say, oh, now in 2 years can be a professional, but everybody is not like Ayuso or Evenepoel. So I think it's a normal cyclist in this moment.
Does he want to become a cyclist?
I don't know. He likes a lot. Also, his father, he understands a little bit of cycling. So I hope that become a good rider, but I don't know because now it's too early for him. So the good thing is that in this moment that he's doing a sport for the rest. I don't know, maybe in the future it will be cyclist, but not now. Now it's a child.
How much are you riding yourself? How much cycling do you do?
Not a lot. For example, the last 2 months, maybe once per week. But normally I want to try every week more training, but just to be fit, not for to be strong or something like before. So I like cycling. I try to do sometimes some small races as a cyclotourist, but not cyclist anymore.
So Oscar, you say you don't ride much. How do you stay so fit looking? You're very slim still, muy delgado.
I am growing up in this moment. So no, I did a lot before. So I remember 2 years ago I was fit because I was doing a lot of training, not on the bike always, but I was doing also in winter time tennis. So I don't want to relax a lot because then it's too difficult to be in a booth healthy. So I think it's better don't take a lot of weight than to do the opposite.
When you were a rider, when you were a cyclist, and there were lots of legends about you, leyendas, no? For example, that even then, you didn't train that much. True or false?
I did a lot of good training. Not so much, but good quality. I think the cycling is changing a little bit. So the riders, they do the same like I was doing before, I think, in my opinion, because it's better to do a very good quality training that to lose hours and hours on the bike.
I remember, so you used to be famous for getting ready for the World Championships and your coaches used to say you could get fit very, very quickly in a month, 6 weeks.
Yeah, I think it's really important to do races before the important race. So to be fit and to be in a good shape, it's important to make a good period of races. So I remember my preparing for the World Championships was a little bit in the Vuelta, and then a good quality training just before the World Championships.
Another thing you were famous for, forgetting things. Well, I saw you walk over there a minute ago and you forgot your mobile phone, you left it here. Do you still forget lots of things?
Yeah, still. In this Vuelta, I am okay till this moment, but for example, my last thing was 1 month ago. I went to the hotel and I forgot the luggage, so I I arrived at home and then I called the agency to take my luggage. It was 300 kilometers from my home, so
you left everything. Sometimes. You left everything in the hotel.
Yeah, the luggage. Yeah. So, but I am really relaxed normally, so it's not a big problem for me.
Last couple of things, another couple of legends, Oscar. I heard that you were crazy about yogurt. Eras enfermo de yogurt. But you had even a spoon in your car, yes. In el coche, no?
Yes, when I was 16 and then also professional, I was always with yogurts and I was eating yogurts also in the car. So also when I was with my girlfriend or my wife, I was eating a lot of yogurts because I like, and still I like. So for me, it's the best dessert for a rider, for sure.
Last legend, you were Spanish scale electric champion, or were you second place? And how old were you?
I never been a national champion. So always world champion in cycling, but in escalestri, electric cars, I was in a second position in the nationals. So I hope to be in the future a national champion in something. I don't know in what. But
maybe eating yogurt.
Maybe. I had to prepare it.
And Oscar, very last thing, who's going to win this Vuelta a España in your opinion?
Before the Vuelta, I say the Evenepoel, and I still is the leader. So in my opinion, is in a good condition, and I think it's the best chance to win the Vuelta for a very young rider.
So Larry, that was Oscar Freire. He retains that ambition of becoming Spanish champion in something. Might not be scale electric, might not be yogurt eating, but could it be cherry stone spitting? What was the official name of the what was the competition in Traverse City?
It's the Cherry Pit Spitting Contest.
Pit Spitting. Maybe Tour de l'Avenir. Maybe there's a Spanish national championship. I don't know. Anyway, yeah. Larry, what do you make of Oscar Freire this morning?
I thought it was pretty interesting. I mean, I appreciated the, you asked him about the yogurt and he just said, because I like, and that was funny. But anyway, one thing I found interesting was the one thing I always heard about Oscar Freire was that he would spend the entire, I mean, I don't know, this could also be just a myth, but like he wouldn't touch his bike the entire winter. And then apparently he'd show up to training camp and, you know, he'd get killed for the first few days, just get his ass totally kicked. And then he'd sort of be okay the middle of training camp. And by the end of training camp, he'd be dropping everyone. And apparently he just the whole winter never touched his bike. The first time he touched it would be the first day of training camp. And I thought that was, you know, I just was like, oh, that's crazy. But then listening to what he said there was that, you know, you asked him, you said something about not training. And he said, actually, like that, I like to do other things, you know, I like to play tennis in winter. And I kind of thought that was interesting because maybe he was sort of an early proponent of cross training and, you know, used all these other ways to stay fit. So yeah, maybe he'd show up to training camp, not having ridden his bike, but he was actually like focused. And it was kind of funny. He also referenced the weight, like we talked about yesterday. Yeah. Obviously that's a big thing that, unfortunately has, intertwined many different places in cycling, but
I mean, he is in absolutely fantastic shape. I mean, he almost looks younger now than he did when he was riding. That said, for a guy who used to win sprint finishes against the fastest riders in the world, he's quite an unimposing character. Well, he has an unimposing physique. He's about 5'9", and he has quite slim calves. And you, to look at him, you'd probably think that he was a climber. But he's also one of those guys, Larry, that you look at him and you look at his demeanor and you watch him move around, and you can almost see him sort of conserving energy, if that makes sense. You can there's nothing that he does and nothing that seems to have any influence on him that would appear to sap any of his sort of life force. And you can imagine that you know, this was certainly a huge advantage when he was a professional cyclist. There are other guys I've encountered over the years who have a similar air about them, but then on the other hand there are guys who seem very uptight and spend their whole time worrying and fretting and being paranoid and maybe borderline neurotic, and they're also very good riders as well. So I suppose there's no universal rule, but that was Oscar Freire. Yeah. A pleasure and a privilege to meet him this morning.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport, who will be fueling my ride again tomorrow. I've got another 100 plus kilometre ride planned tomorrow, and I'm just sorting through what I've got left in stock here. I'm going to take the beta fuel in my bidons, mix that up into the drink, and that pretty much keeps me going, to be honest. But I will also take a couple of energy bakes and a couple of energy gels, the Go energy gels. And well, I'll have something to offer to Simon if he starts to feel a little bit tired in the second half of our ride. If you want to get 25% off everything at scienceinsport.com, go to scienceinsport.com and use the discount code SISCP25.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Well, last night I promised on the podcast I would eat some flamenquin. This was, how do I describe it? It was kind of, it's a bit like a schnitzel, but it's also got jamón ibérico in it, and it's also in the shape of a kind of a baton.
rather than a flat slab. It was pretty good, but I was quite surprised that in Cordoba it was served as an entrante, as a starter, which I thought was slightly unusual. Also had a glass of nice Montilla, which we mentioned in the podcast yesterday, is sherry-like wine, which is sometimes drunk as an aperitif, so that's what I did last night. Larry, well, I should also mention, it's got nothing to do with food, but as stated, as explained last year, or as recommended last year, Cordoba is a destination that I would advise anyone to go to if they get the opportunity. It's famous for its mosque/cathedral. It used to be a mosque built in the 8th century, their mezquita, and, well, became a cathedral after the Reconquista, and it is an extraordinary building in an extraordinary city, so it was very enjoyable spending some time there. We'll be spending time in another city tonight, Granada, with a famous Moorish heritage, a Muslim heritage, so looking forward to that as well. But Larry, let's get back to the cycling. Tell us what we've got coming tomorrow.
Yeah, so tomorrow I believe will be the hardest stage, or the hardest at least finishing climb of the race. It's stage 15 from Martos to Sierra Nevada, 152.6 kilometers, 3,983 meters of climbing. The finish is at 2,432 meters after a 22-kilometer climb. It has a super steep start, and yeah, it's going to be pretty hot at the bottom, maybe about 30 degrees, so that's going to make for a really hard day. Yeah, I guess for me, I can really envision, after his performance today, I would probably predict a Miguel Angel Lopez victory.
Yeah, I think you're on the money there.
Yeah, I just think Astana needs it.
He won the last time.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Yeah.
But the sad thing is that they were originally going to finish, I don't know if you know this, but they were going to finish at like 2,900 meters. And I don't know what happened, if they didn't get approval or what, so they stop at this kind of observatory or whatever.
What happened, I believe, is that the race has only ever finished at the current altitude because the Vuelta going to Sierra Nevada, it predates the creation of the ratification of the national park up there in Sierra Nevada. And there was a rule whereby any event that had taken place before this national park status was granted could continue to go to the Sierra Nevada and could continue to go to those same locations. And that was the case with the Vuelta, but there's no real wriggle room to do anything different from what they've done before. And I think there were other environmental concerns raised as well, pertaining particularly to that spot, 2,800 meters above sea level. We'll talk a bit more about that maybe in just a second with someone who should know, and I think he does know a little bit more about Sierra Nevada. But let's first go to a couple of other individuals, well, who'll be in the thick of the action tomorrow. Adi Engels, the Jumbo-Visma director sportif. I asked him this morning, I asked him about Primoz Roglic and how he was looking to Adi, and I also asked him about the Sierra Nevada, where Jumbo-Visma have trained in the past. And then I spoke to Ben O'Connor, your teammate Larry for AG2R, who has also spent a lot of time at altitude on the Sierra Nevada. We talked, among other things, about wildlife. Larry, I think you've been up there with him, haven't you?
I was, yeah. I was up there with him before the Tour de France this year. So we actually, us and Jumbo were the only two teams staying at the center at that time. So kind of funny.
Well, let's hear from Adi Engels. And, that center you mentioned, it's the High Performance Center up on the Sierra Nevada. So it's Adi Engels and then Ben O'Connor.
Yeah, we know the roads, but I think every pro cyclist more or less knows the roads. So it's I think it's not too tactical, too specific in that way. Tomorrow is such a long, hard climb. In the end, it comes down to the legs, and also what you had to spend until now. It will add up in some way. And same for today, but of course tomorrow the finish climb will be a lot harder, a lot longer, high altitude. So it's going to be something different, but it's the legs will decide.
And how do you see Primoz at the moment? What do you think his frame of mind is? How does he look to you generally?
He has a great fighting spirit. He feels he's improving. He also sees the guys improving next to him. in the team. So he's really looking forward to this weekend and try to have different standings, or at least be closer on Sunday evening.
And Sierra Nevada tomorrow. You were up there before the Vuelta, weren't you?
Yeah.
Well, just talk to us a bit about the experience of living in that. It's the big sort of sports center up there, is it? Is that where you were?
Yeah, I was staying in the car center. It's okay. It has everything that you need, but I wouldn't say it's like really beautiful. It was nice up there though, because we had some great heat training, great heat adaptation before Dauphiné. And the climbs really are conducive, both to riding easy actually, funnily enough, because on the highway it's not so hard, or really hard like it is at the bottom of the stage for La Volta and Hazayanas. So then you've got quite varied terrain. Plus, at the bottom, it's flat, more or less, so there's quite a lot of sections that you can do time trial work. So that's why it's so popular.
What did you do in your spare time up there? Did you get a chance to sort of absorb the surroundings, go for walks, I don't know, discover the wildlife?
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of ibex up there. I mean, it's full of ibex. So that was quite beautiful, walking around. You know, I mean, it was really not very difficult to find them. You walk up onto the ridges. There wasn't a lot of snow left when we were there. When you're there in March, you can go skiing if you like. But yeah, it is quite a barren,
it's a big danger,
like windswept terrain up there. So barring the ibex, there's not a ton else. But the views are stunning, and the sunsets were special to watch every night.
And just lastly, will it help you tomorrow?
Maybe. Yeah. I think knowing the first part of the climb on Hazayanas, to know when it's going to stop, is going to help you. Because it feels pretty relentless when you're on it. And if you know where it's going to finish, it's going to help you a lot.
Ben O'Connor, they're talking about ibexes. We've been joined now by, I don't know whether he's the ibex of Almería. He's certainly a fan favourite here on the Cycling Podcast. Again, this is not an official feature. I talked about the national parks being ratified. This feature has not been ratified officially yet, but Gazing Wistfully with Fran Reyes makes its return today. And here is Fran. What have you got for us today?
Hello, everyone. Nice to be here again. You know, today I have been gazing wistfully because I was undergoing a mild hangover. You know, so when I arrived to the top of the Sierra de la Pandera, I only felt like I needed to sit and stare at the blank, you know, to reflect on my eyes what there was on my brain. And so I sat down there on the Sierra de la Pandera on some rocks, looking at the landscape here in Jaén, because Jaén, it is perceived as a pretty flat and boring land, but actually,
anything but flat.
Exactly, it's anything but flat, anything but boring. There is quite different landscapes here, especially if we go to the other corner of the province. You will find there some of the greenest mountain environments in Spain. Seriously, Sierra de Cazorla. I think we have been there with the Vuelta.
We have, Fran. Yeah. And of course, this evening, what I mentioned earlier in the podcast, I'll be staying in Granada this evening. That's a place that you have called home for quite a long time, isn't it?
Yeah, 9 years already, man. When I think of that, I am aging. I am aging so much.
We discussed this as well. You're aging. Your accelerated aging process. Fran, you also know, you know everything around here. You know the Sierra Nevada. You've climbed those climbs, as has Larry. We'll ask him about them in a minute. Tell us about them.
I mean, you know, Larry, he has climbed these climbs, but he climbed them faster than me. So he had less time to repair on the details, you know, to collect details. I don't know, maybe some listeners, some hardcore cycling podcast fans, remember this Kilometer Zero I did, I think it was 2018 or 2017 on Sierra Nevada. We were doing exactly this stage with a climb to El Purche, then a fast descent to Huejar Sierra, and the climb up to from Hazayanas to all the way to the Olla de la Mora. I did all those climbs while recording myself. It was a pretty interesting experience, and also a great test for my shape. I think if tomorrow I was to do the same climbs, I would be unable. You know, I mean, well, I could do it, but I would have to walk for a while, you know. And yeah, these are very demanding climbs, you know. El Purche in particular, it's quite steady, whereas Azayanas, it's steady but with double-digit gradients. So it asks for a lot of concentration, especially from the riders. You have to be very focused if you want to remain at a good pace and if you want to not give up, because it's easy to give up on those kind of climbs.
Larry, Alejandro Valverde pretty much lost the 2006 Vuelta on El Purche to Alexander Vinokourov. Could Remco Evenepoel, I've been getting that wrong throughout tonight's podcast again. Let's rephrase the question. Is tomorrow the ideal follow-up, the ideal chaser for Primoz Roglic after today?
Yeah, I believe it is. I mean, you know, if there is potentially a little bit of faltering on the part of Remco, I think tomorrow is a day you don't want to have an ounce of weakness, just because it's just so hard. So already it's funny because I'm looking at the profile right now, and you know, the climb before the climb to Sierra Nevada is Monachil, and that already is a super hard climb. But if you look at the profile, it actually looks quite small and easy relative to the final climb. So to have that is sort of like the entree, the appetizer. Before Sierra Nevada, it's just going to make it really brutal. So, I mean, if someone already starts to put pressure there, we could really see enormous time gaps tomorrow. So it's definitely going to be an exciting final to watch.
Well, chaps, I'm certainly excited. As I said, I stand by what I said at the start of the podcast. There is blood in the water tonight, I think. Blood coming maybe from the red jersey, maybe coming from Remco Evenepoel's red jersey. That just about concludes the entertainment for this evening. Tomorrow, I'll be joined by Brian Nygaard. That's if he doesn't listen to tonight's podcast. Hear that Larry Warbass is in La Mora and getting his car in Pietrasanta. Make a beeline for the Lange Hills and enjoy knees up with you tonight, Larry. I'm hoping Brian will still join me tomorrow. But I'm going to thank Fran for his wistful gazing. More of that, we hope, tomorrow. Oh, Fran, what shall I eat in Granada tonight? Very quickly.
Oh, well, you should go to the city centre and find some gazpacho.
Oh, okay. Gazpacho, I can eat that. That's fine. And I'm going to thank you, Larry.
We'll be
hearing from you again next week. I think we've got a long stint for you next week. Not sure exactly which days yet, but we're gonna define that in the next few hours, aren't we, Larry?
Yeah, sounds great. Looking forward to it.
Well, enjoy your evening, Larry. Enjoy the wine in particular. Think of us and enjoy tomorrow's stage.
Will do.
Good night from me. Good night from Fran.
Good night.
And good night from Larry.
Good night, guys.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.